Okay, thanks. I'll mostly be focusing on oceans and similar to what Hitoshi was talking about before, sort of normal ocean, what you might think of as normal ocean, 100-million-year-old Pacific is what I'll be focusing on. I'll compare briefly to low-velocity zone under continents as well, and talk a little bit about age dependence. So just some reminders about the nature of the low-velocity zone. It's been pretty well characterized for a long time now, and observations of quantification of it is getting better and better. It's a local minimum in the seismic wave velocity. That means the velocity decreases with increasing depth, unlike almost any other part of the Earth, so it's very unusual in that sense. So you have this negative velocity gradient. And as we've heard in some of the previous talks, this low velocity zone, which is something we can measure very well with seismology and so on, is often associated with other things that are not quite as well measured, including a zone of high seismic wave attenuation. We can measure that, of course, but the depth resolution is not as great as for depth variation of velocities. High electrical conductivity, we saw some results of those earlier, and possibly low viscosity. This is not something that we can really measure with any depth resolution on this scale at all. And this is just a reminder that the low velocity zone does vary quite a bit from one region to another. TNA is for tectonic North America, that includes also some young ocean. PA5 is for older Pacific. The Atlantic appears to have perhaps a shallower low velocity zone than the Pacific does. This is shield North America. This is under stable North America, and so a very shallow low velocity zone there, and just the global PREM model for comparison. In terms of the scope of what I'll be talking about, I will be talking mostly about the ocean, and I'll be talking mostly about ocean away from the ridge, okay? So I do want to really focus on what you might call normal oceanic mantle, basically everything that's in blue here. And this map also reminds us of one of the reasons why we care about the low velocity zone is that a number of geodynamical modeling studies from Mark Richards, Adrian Lenardich, Paul Tackley, have thought of a low viscosity channel as being an essential enabler of plate tectonics, actually. In order to get plate-like behavior with a sort of piecewise continuous velocity field at the surface, some modeling studies at least suggest that you really need some kind of low viscosity channel beneath the plate. So potentially very important part of the Earth's dynamical system. So in terms of the origin of the low velocity zone, why does the Earth have a low velocity zone? The answer is actually really simple. And it's just that the geothermal gradient, the variation of temperature with pressure along the geotherm, is greater than this quantity beta S. And what this quantity does is it compares the variation of shear wave velocity with pressure to the variation of shear wave velocity with temperature. This is about 30 degrees per kilometer. This is about 2 degrees per kilometer. And so just because temperature varies so rapidly in the upper thermal boundary layer, the effect of temperature wins out over the effect of pressure, and velocities decrease with increasing depth. So just on the basis of heat flow observations, which constrain this near-surface DTDP, we should expect the low-velocity zone to be widespread, and that is in good accord with seismic observations indeed. So qualitatively, the origin of the low-velocity zone is simple. Quantitatively, it's a little more interesting, a question. How low is low? How low is that lowest velocity in the low velocity zone? And can we explain it quantitatively? And can we explain things like age dependence of the low velocity zone and so on? In order to address that question, what we did some time ago is to construct what we refer to as a null hypothesis. And the reason for this was because there were a number of other explanations in the literature at that time, besides just the subsolidus temperature gradient, as to what caused the low velocity zone. Partial melt, water, attenuation, something else. And all of these things are more or less poorly constrained. Certainly in 2005 they are. They're better constrained now. and I'll show you some updates of our arguments a bit later. So what we wanted to focus on was what we call the null hypothesis. That is a variation of velocity with depth in the mantle from the simplest possible model we could think of that would produce a low velocity zone that matched seismic wave velocities pretty well in other parts of the Earth outside of this strange low velocity zone region, that was experimentally and theoretically well defined and that had the minimum number of variables. And so the definition of this null hypothesis is in the elastic limit. That is, it doesn't have any attenuation, okay? Why? Because attenuation is poorly constrained. So we just let's just look at this null hypothesis first, see how it does, then we'll think about including these other effects later. Fixed bulk composition, thermodynamic equilibrium, and in that case, the properties of this null hypothesis just depend on the pressure, the temperature, and the major element composition. Why do I say major element composition? Because things like water and CO2 don't affect the velocity in the elastic limit. They affect the attenuation, and we'll come back to that later, but not the elastic wave velocities. And how do we compute the properties of this null hypothesis? We compute it with our thermodynamic model called Hephaesto. And just to give you a flavor for how Hephaesto, this thermodynamic model and code is constructed, what we do is we assemble a variety of different experimental data, including the variation of elastic moduli with pressure and temperature, also thermochemical data, heat capacity, entropy, and so on, also phase equilibria, one component, and whole rock variations of compositions of phases with pressure and temperature, and the sort of principle that we follow in constructing the thermodynamic model is that all of these different kinds of data measured by different groups at different times and apparently disconnected from each other are in fact very closely related to each other, and they are all manifestations of some underlying function, which is the Gibbs free energy as a function of the stress tensor, the temperature, and the composition. So if we can construct this one function, we can compute all these quantities self-consistently, most importantly for the low velocities and the phase equilibria and the phase compositions and their elastic wave velocities. These are some more technical details of our thermodynamic model. We have improved it since we wrote our last paper on the LVZ by adding a sixth component. We've added sodium now that changes things, especially at the shallowest depths. And some more technical details about this. We have 21 phases now, 47 species, data from about 200 different experimental studies, and we also use ab initio calculations, mostly as a way of guiding functional forms, sometimes as constraints on parameter values in cases where experiments don't exist. And these are some results. This is just showing the decompressed density as a function of pressure and temperature as a way of highlighting phase transitions. So as you go from the olivine dominant assemblage at relatively low pressures to the Wadsleyite and Ringwoodite dominated assemblages, that zero pressure density increases sharply. We'll of course be focusing on this lower pressure region here, below the 410 kilometer discontinuity, to focus on the low velocity zone. And I'll also be focusing on this isentrope corrected by a half-space cooling model as we go to the surface. This just emphasizes that we compute mantle isentropes also self-consistently with the phase equilibrium and the physical properties, and this emphasizes that we compute the seismic wave velocity self-consistently with the phase equilibria as well. Okay, so what are our results? So this is an update of the figure that we have in our 2005 paper in which Hitoshi showed before. The elastic limit is actually very similar to our 2005 result. The biggest differences are here at shallow depths where the velocity is a bit more constant than what we found in 2005, perhaps in better agreement with this idea of the seismic lid, and that's due to the inclusion of sodium, which sort of ameliorates the effect of the Plage to Spinel to Garnet transitions a bit. The envelope is an estimate of uncertainties due to underlying uncertainties in the experimental data that go into constraining the model. So this is the null hypothesis. This is in the elastic limit, and it's along a 1600 Kelvin isentrope corrected with a half-space cooling model for 100 million-year-old oceanic lithosphere. And what you can see is that even with no attenuation, no partial melt, no nothing, you get a very well-defined low velocity zone. It's at the right depth. And the lowest velocities here are quite a bit lower than they are in other parts of the mantle. They're not quite as low as seismic models show. And so we refer to this as a residual velocity deficit of maybe a tenth to two-tenths of a kilometer per second that we need to still explain. The other thing I'm not showing in this figure, but which Hitoshi showed before, is that this null hypothesis also has a very sensible age relationship. So if you compare the depth of the at which the lowest velocity occurs or the value of the lowest velocity as a function of lithospheric age, you find very nice agreement with seismic models. Okay, so how can we explain this residual velocity deficit? Okay, that's the first thing I'll focus on, and then I'll come back to focus on two other questions, two other points where our null hypothesis differ significantly from the seismic models, and those will be this relatively sharp decrease in velocity here, which has been called the G discontinuity. It's also been called the LAB. And I'll also come back to this zone at the bottom of the low velocity zone, where the velocity varies much more rapidly with depth in the seismic models than it does in our null hypothesis. Okay, so first the residual velocity deficit. How can we explain this? Well, the natural thing to look at first, I think, is attenuation, because seismology tells us that there is attenuation in the low velocity zone. It is a high attenuation zone. It's natural to include it. And just a reminder, attenuation and dispersion, what they are, is that seismic observations are all at finite frequency. They're not at infinite frequency. And at seismic frequencies, it turns out that as the seismic wave passes, it causes motion of defects, sliding of grain boundaries, and so on, dissipative processes that absorb energy and attenuate the energy in the seismic wave. This attenuation entails dispersion, that is a frequency dependence of the velocity, so the velocity at finite frequency is less than the velocity to infinite frequency. Most laboratory measurements are done at effectively infinite frequency, megahertz to gigahertz. The velocities are identical, measured by various techniques, whether Brillouin scattering or ultrasonics. But as you go to the sort of hertz range, the observation is, in the lab as well, that the velocity is significantly less and the attenuation significantly higher. This is a cartoon from Ian Jackson. Just recently, he's been publishing more and more data from his experimental apparatus at ANU, measuring these effects on olivine polycrystals. And the nice thing about these measurements is that they are conducted at seismic frequencies, that is 1 to 1,000 second periods, and they're conducted at mantle temperatures up to 1,200 degrees C. So very nice there. Just a note of caution that some extrapolation, of course, is still required. As wonderful as these data are, they're not quite at low velocity zone conditions, and they differ perhaps critically in two ways. The pressure is only 0.2 GPa, not the 3 GPa that you want to compare directly to the low velocity zone. So we don't really know what the effect of pressure is on attenuation yet, unfortunately. And also the grain size is too small. The grain size is reported here, 3 microns. They have data up to a few hundred microns, I believe, but not up to the sort of millimeter to centimeter scale that you would expect to find perhaps in the mantle. Anyway, so this is some of their data. And this is as a function of the oscillation period, going from 1 second out to 1,000 seconds. And what you see is that as the period increases, the attenuation goes up, increases, and it also increases with increasing temperature from 800 to 1200 degrees C. And as the attenuation goes up, the shear modulus, or equivalently the shear wave velocity, decreases, and it decreases more rapidly at high temperature than it does at low temperature. Okay, one thing to point out here, notice how the lines here are from a model that they have fit to their data, not only to this data, but to a wide variety of other data on many other specimens at different grain sizes and different conditions and different fabrication methods. Anyway, what this model shows is that the attenuation decreases with increasing frequency or decreasing period systematically until you get to here. And then the attenuation only decreases up to a point and then kind of flattens off. And there's the hint of this peak. Now, I'll come back to this peak later. It's not very well constrained by the data, all right? But there is a hint of it in the data, and they chose to model their data this way. And I'll come back to this sort of extra peak, sort of lurking at the edge of the data a little bit later. Okay, well, let's just apply their model to the null, add it to the null hypothesis and see what we get. And this is what we get. So here's the null hypothesis again. Here is including the effect of attenuation from the Fowle and Jackson 2005 model or from the Jackson and Fowle 2010 model. And what you see is that attenuation explains the residual velocity deficit beautifully, almost too well. It agrees beautifully with the minimum velocities that the seismic models see. Let's see, this is for constant 1 centimeter grain size. I've tried to keep it really simple, this calculation. Again, the same simple 1600 K adiabat corrected with a 100 million year old conductive cooling near the surface. And some other interesting things are that the velocity drops quite rapidly here at the top of the low velocity zone. And it drops as rapidly as the Nishimura and Forsyth model here, as rapidly as this drop here. I would be tempted to call this a sharp drop in velocity. I think it's an interesting question whether this can produce receiver function type conversions of the kind that are observed under normal oceanic mantle, like in Hitoshi's data. It produces this much sharper velocity drop than the null hypothesis does, reproduces this residual velocity deficit. Notice, though, that it doesn't help at all with this high gradient zone at the bottom of the low velocity zone. Let me just say a little bit more about this G discontinuity. If we need to sharpen it up, how could we do it to explain the receiver function data? A lot of suggestions have been put forward, partial melt, water, anisotropy, and this extra band absorption. Let me just say a few words about each of those. Partial melt. The problem with partial melt is that the low velocity zone is cold. All right, from the point of view of melting, the low velocity zone is cold. The melting temperature rises very, very rapidly with pressure. By the time you get to the minimum velocities, around 150 kilometers, you're way below even the wet solidus, hundreds of degrees too cold to have any melt there. Now, melt is different from melting and freezing are different from solid-solid transitions. It's not kinetically hindered. You don't get metastable wedges of melt, okay? Like you might of olivine in a subducting slab. The kinetics of melting and freezing are quick. And so if this is what the temperature is, you can't have melt in the low velocity zone. This is the dry prototype solidus. This is for 200 ppm water, which is at the sort of upper end of what you might expect in normal mantle. Now, Mark Hirschman has shown that if there's CO2 present, and there's one of the posters over there, shows some nice evidence of CO2 in cratonic lithosphere from mineral inclusions. If CO2 is present, then you can get very small amounts of melting throughout the low velocity zone because CO2 is so incompatible, it basically doesn't want to be in minerals at all. And so you get a very tiny bit of melting throughout the low velocity zone. But how much? You can see the contours here. The amount of melt is less than 0.1%. Okay, really minuscule amounts of melt. So can you completely exclude melt from the low velocity zone? No, but the amount of melt is so tiny, according to thermodynamic equilibrium anyway, that it's effectively zero because 0.1% partial melt won't affect seismic wave velocities at all. Not measurably anyway. What about water? Corrado and Jung had this idea that you could sharpen the G discontinuity with water, okay, with a dehydration front caused by partial melting. It's an interesting idea. The basic idea, as the mantle rises, it starts partial melting. All the water goes into the partial melt and leaves, leaving behind a very dry residuum. Okay, so attenuation will decrease very sharply because attenuation increases with water content. So if you dry it out, attenuation suddenly goes to zero. The problem is that attenuation isn't that big an effect to begin with. So if you completely remove attenuation, the effect on velocity is really limited to 1 or 2%. And that's nice, and it shows up in their figures, actually. I mean, here's the effect of water on sharpening the G discontinuity. The region of this slightly steepened velocity gradient covers a very small percentage change in the shear wave velocity. So to me, this doesn't quite work as an explanation of a sharper G discontinuity than what we found. What about anisotropy? This is just a reminder that when you are looking at receiver functions, you're looking at the slower of the two S-wave polarizations, normally referred to as SV, perhaps confusingly, but it would be the SV that you're sensitive to in a receiver function study, and that's the slower of the two. So you would tend to go from slower shear wave velocity in the asthenosphere to faster in a region that isn't anisotropic above it. And this is just an example, one study where Ben et al. Looked at focusing of dislocation strain in the asthenosphere and related it to anisotropy in the asthenosphere. One possible way of focusing, maybe with a variety of grain sizes or different phases, maybe you can sharpen this a little bit more. Just an idea. The other idea that's recently been put forward from Carato's group at Yale is that there's an extra absorption peak. This is what I was referring to earlier when we were looking at the absorption data. An extra absorption peak lurking. What I mean by lurking is that it's actually not in the data. It's at the edge of the data. It's at the edge of the experimental data. It's at the edge of what seismology can see for the observation so far. But if that lurking peak can somehow shift into the seismic band by changing pressure or temperature or water content, then all kinds of strange and wonderful things can happen. And you can get very sharp reductions in the seismic wave velocity depending on the width of this extra, still poorly constrained absorption band. Which Carato et al. And also Jackson and Fowle before him associated with elastically accommodated grain boundary sliding, which is theoretically predicted to occur. It is predicted to give you a several percent drop in shear wave velocity at relatively high frequencies, and it is very reasonable to expect that the frequency of this peak will shift with pressure, temperature, and water content in more or less the right way. Whether quantitatively it does that is an open question still and will require more experimental data. Let me turn finally to that high gradient zone. The high gradient zone, again, what I'm referring to is the fact that seismic models have this very steep velocity gradient below the low velocity zone, much steeper than our null hypothesis. And one idea that people have looked at, including Camerano and Romanovich, is that that high gradient zone might be a cause of a change in bulk composition with depth. Caroline and I have looked at this idea that the mantle might be a mechanical mixture of basalt and hartsburgite, and if you can change the relative proportions of those two as a function of depth, that could contribute to a higher velocity gradient. Here you see peroxenite has a much higher velocity than pyrolite over the relevant range, and so if you can go from this stuff to this stuff as a function of depth, maybe you can explain a higher gradient. This is also interesting because if you look at geodynamical models of that mechanically mixed mantle, what you find is a pileup of basalt just above the upper mantle, lower mantle boundary. So you do get this positive increase in basalt fraction with increasing depth right in this range. Very intriguing. The problem I have with this idea, though, is that the increase in basalt fraction is pretty subtle. It's pretty minor, and I don't think it's enough to explain the much higher seismic wave velocity gradients that you see in seismology. Fowle and Jackson suggested that there's a depth dependence to the grain size in the mantle. If it's only a millimeter in the low velocity zone and then transitions to something like 5 centimeters in that high gradient zone, you can produce much steeper velocity gradients, although even they don't quite match the seismic models down here at 400 kilometers depth. I don't know if that's geodynamically, mineralogically plausible or not, to increase the grain size by a factor of 50 over 200 kilometers. One study that examined this in somewhat more detail was the study of Benn et al. Again, where they looked at strain and strain rates and what that might do to grain sizes, and they find much more subtle variations in grain size as a function of depth over this range. In fact, depending on what you assume about the activation volume associated with grain growth, the grain size can actually decrease with increasing depth. Okay, the other possibility for explaining that high gradient zone is that the temperature distribution is different from what we've typically assumed. Remember, I'm assuming a 1600 Kelvin isentrope in this region of the high gradient zone. Maybe it's not an isentrope. To address that question, what we've done is to take the model TNA, corrected for anisotropy, which is this bold red line here. And what we've done is we've taken our null hypothesis plus Fallon-Jackson or Jackson to Fowle attenuation and just found the temperature that matched the seismic wave velocity at every depth. And this is the result of that exercise. What we find using the Fallon-Jackson 05 or the Jackson to Fowle 2010, these are the temperatures that match TNA, all right? This is the temperature profile that matches it. And what you can see is that there's some similarity to an isentrope, this is actually a 1500 Kelvin isentrope here for comparison, we're in the right ballpark in terms of temperature, and that makes sense with the good agreement we found before between our null hypothesis plus attenuation compared to seismic models. The temperature distribution isn't isentropic either. This can be the thermal boundary layer, that's okay. But then it reaches a maximum, and then the temperature actually starts decreasing with increasing depth below that. That decreasing temperature with increasing depth gives you the much steeper velocity gradients that you need to match the seismology. And while this is an interesting exercise, the question remains, is this geodynamically plausible? I don't know the answer to that, but I will refer you to two geodynamical models that have been performed. This is from Tackley et al. 1993. This is a more recent one from Rodri Davies, who we're working together with on various things. And what both of these models show are decreasing temperature with increasing depth right in that relevant range, right at the base of the low velocity zone. These decreases in temperature, I believe, are related to the fact that there are phase transitions with negative Clapeyron slopes in these models. And that could be causing this decrease in temperature with depth. In any case, what we all know about, you know, vigorously convecting mantle being isentropic, obviously we all know that, right? Except that that's not necessarily true if you have spherical geometry, radioactive heat-producing elements, or phase transitions. That can break the simple picture that we have of the isentropic gradient in convecting systems. And I'll leave the conclusions on the slide here. Basically, the null hypothesis is still doing very well in terms of producing a low velocity zone with the right age dependence and so on. Including attenuation from the laboratory data explains the residual velocity deficit. Now, and that's different from our 2005, where we still weren't quite explaining it with seismologically derived attenuation models. It does produce this large magnitude, and I would say fairly sharp decrease in velocity at the top of the low velocity zone. Partial melt in the low velocity zone, I think, is difficult to reconcile with thermodynamics. And the high gradient zone you could explain with variations in entropy with depth. Thank you. Thank you.